From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast, is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week, we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet, or the algorithm, choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame starting May 7th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
On the latest season of the Next Question with Katie Couric podcast, Katie dives into, well, Katie. Hear exclusive podcast-only conversations between Katie and the people who made her memoir, Going There, possible.
Katie is a pack rat, and she has basically her own archive of sorts in her basements.
Plus, Katie explores some of the big news stories she's covered over the decades and the people behind them, like Anita Hill.
I thought I could just get back to my life, and that wasn't possible. It was not going to be the same.
There's plenty of Katie's signature curiosity and no-holds-barred interviews, along with some of her own revealing answers.
We spent a lot of time together around a dining room table here and in the city, and, you know, it was a very intense experience.
All episodes of Next Question with Katie Couric are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Hillary Clinton, and I'm so excited to be back with a third season of You and Me Both. When I started this podcast, we were going through some tough times, and let's face it, we still are. And here's what I know, we cannot get through this alone. So please join me for more conversations with people who will make you think, make you laugh, and help us find a path forward. This season, I'll be talking about the state of our democracy with experts and with people organizing on the ground. We'll draw inspiration from some amazing people like Olympic star Allison Felix and Grammy Award winner Brandi Carlile. And we'll get into the hard stuff with writer Cheryl Strayed and my dear friend and colleague Huma Abedin. So join us, listen to You and Me Both on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Sarah Wendell, and for close to 20 years, I've been a widely recognized expert in the world of romance.
And I'm Alicia Rye, best-selling author of over 20 romance novels.
Introducing iHeart's new romance podcast, Love Struck Daily.
Every day, we deliver a new love story straight to your headphones.
Real-life love stories, 100% guaranteed to bring all the feels.
A little bit of sexy, a little bit of danger, and a lot of heart.
Who doesn't need more love like this?
Who wants to go on a first date with me on Instagram Live?
Are you serious?
Oh, real-life fairy tale right there.
Badass lady pirate Mary takes her shirt off.
Let me show you pirate style.
And it just unbuttoned her shirt
just
and tucked
it off.
And for goodness sakes,
just kiss already.
Listen to Love Struck Daily on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm in love with you.
I'm Steve Carell, and I played Michael Scott on The Office.
Well, hello, everyone. Yes, it is time. It's the one you've been waiting for, I'm sure. Well, first of all, welcome to this week's episode of The Office Deep Dive. I am your host, Brian Baumgartner. I got ahead of myself. I could not be any more excited to present my guest today, Mr. Steve Carell. Now, Steve was the star of the 2007 comedy, Evan Almighty. All right. No, but I mean, talk about someone who truly needs no introduction, which is probably a good thing because there's literally no way that I could put into words just how incredible Steve is, even though it's like my job. My entire job is just to put things into words, and I clearly can't. Maybe this is the best way to explain it. During this conversation, the one you're about to hear, Steve basically said that it is so hard to talk about The Office without hyperbole, that he didn't want to be like, it's the greatest or, you know, whatever. But honestly, that is how I feel about Steve. It's really hard to talk about Steve without hyperbole because he truly is the absolute greatest. I could go on forever, and I kind of do in this conversation. So let me just say this. I hope you enjoy this just as much as I did. Here he is, the incomparable Steve Carell.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
Oh my God!
How are you? How are you doing?
I'm so good. It's so good to see you. Oh my gosh! It's been too long.
I know. I was just saying to your producer.
Yes.
Where do you want me here?
Yeah, I want you there.
Okay.
Oh my God.
How was life?
I mean,
sorry, I'm late. I just,
please. I know. I literally just saw, and I texted. I said, "Oh, he's 10 minutes late," but that's now. So, are you still doing the thing where you, because you bought the general store, right?
Yeah.
Is that's still your,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I was somewhere in New York or something, and someone came up and had something for me to sign. Somewhere they knew it clearly I was going to be, and they had this thing, and I said, "Oh, you got Steve." I said, I don't normally see Steve. And he said, "Once a year, you do a day? Is this true?" You're laughing.
Kind of,
once,
yes.
Once
yeah.
a year, you do a day where you sign at the general store?
Well, they every year, this radio station does a little remote from the porch of the general store.
Okay.
And just to promote the store, and sure. My sister-in-law runs it, and, you know, it's sort of a festive kickoff of summer thing. And I go and I do an interview with them on the porch, and, like, 10, 15 people would show up and watch it. And then if anyone wanted an autograph or a picture, I'd stay and I'd do that. So
this guy claimed he stayed for hours.
This last year was a
okay.
big, there were a lot more people there.
Right.
Cause I think with The Office, I think the fact that, I mean, I'm sure you've talked a lot to many people.
Yes.
About exactly that. But boy, in the past couple of years, yeah, that's changed. Just the tone of that has changed, that little get together.
I mean, you're a very, very fancy movie star now, but how much is it for you now, The Office still?
Oh, most of it. I mean, that's right. Yeah. I saw Creed, and on Space Force, I'm working with a bunch of Office people.
Yes.
And I think everyone feels that same sort of, it's just odd. It's odd that when we were doing the show, and I'm sure you feel the same way, we're sort of in a vacuum to a certain extent. I never got the sense that the show was a hit by any means, or it was popular enough to keep it on the air, but we didn't have people hanging outside the sound stages.
Very rarely.
Yeah.
Occasionally, I mean, we'd have a bogey stop by.
Very rare.
We just pull that closer.
Oh,
to
sure,
your face.
Sure, sure.
No,
I can
no,
lean
it's
in.
Fine. No, no. You can move it.
Very
wherever.
Incredibly rare did that ever happen. So, and we were out in the middle of nowhere shooting the thing. So I think none of us got a sense that, which was great, because then it was just about doing the show and having fun and bonding and doing good work. Everyone was so committed to it. But yeah, in these past couple of years, I'll tell you when I really noticed it was when I was taking my daughter to her college. We did tours.
Yes.
And this was two years ago now. I had no idea that it was as popular on college campuses as it seems to have become. And it kind of freaked my daughter out a little bit,
right,
because it became a bit of a thing. And, you know, she was fine. But I think that was the first, I mean, and that was just a couple of years ago, the first sense that I got that it had changed. You know, that temperature had changed a bit.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, it's crazy because we were the number one scripted show on NBC for a long time.
Were we?
We were. I know.
Never, see, but I they never had got nothing. A sense of any of that.
They had nothing.
I guess.
Yeah, but it's so much bigger now.
Yeah, it's definitely changed. And it's, you know, how can you not be happy about that, that people found it? Because I think when we were doing it, we all felt it was special. We all felt that there were elements of the show that I feel like people see it more fully upon repeated viewing.
Yeah. Well, it was complex and
I think more so than I think people assumed it was initially.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to tout it too much because that's the other thing. I don't want to sit back and say, oh, you know, it's a classic and it's this and that and that's why people love it. I'm surprised, frankly, that it had the second life that it seems to have.
Yeah.
And people we've talked about it. I've talked to Nancy about it, my wife, about why. Well, for starters, why was it able to stay on the air in the first place?
Right.
Because it was a remake of a very heralded show, and it did not get good reviews out of the block. And everyone, I remember before I auditioned, I was talking to Paul Rudd, and I'd never seen the original one. And he asked what I was up to. This was around, I think it was right after Anchorman, I was going to audition. And I told him I was going to audition for the American version of The Office. And he said, "Duh, don't do it. Oh, bad, bad move, dude. I mean, it's never going to be as good."
Right.
Like what everybody was saying.
Right.
So it's, I think, a miracle that it even lasted, you know, that first, second season. I mean, it was like we'd get two episodes, then they'd move it up to six episodes. So the orders weren't, there wasn't a lot of confidence in the show for a long time.
Yeah, my favorite review, there's a gentleman by the name of David Bianculli. He wrote the following. This was after the pilot. "Where Ricky Gervais let the boss's insecurity shine through, Steve Carell is all noise and stupidity, like a sketch comedy character, not a real person. Not just foolish, but a fool."
Yeah, he was never, I mean, he was never a fan of the show.
He never was?
No.
You know him.
I don't know him personally.
Oh, okay.
But I know, I've read other things that he's written
right.
about the show, and it was, I don't know who he wrote for. But that was, it wasn't just him. I
no,
think it was kind
it was
of
a lot.
That was pretty common. I think across the board, there was not a lot of critical love for the show, which is interesting because I think we all just disagreed. I think we felt like we were onto something, and it wasn't the British version, and it was something unto itself. It was based on all of the components that were making it up. I think Greg Daniels, man, one of, I think, his great talents is choosing people who have chemistry, both professionally and personally. Everybody got along. I mean, people, we loved each other. on that show. I mean, when I just walked in and saw you, I felt like crying. It was such a special thing, I think, to all of us. And I think we're all very protective of it. And, you know, reviews, good, bad, it's okay.
Totally.
People have their own opinions and they're entitled to them. And I you can't take any of that too seriously. But at the same time, I think we all had confidence that we were doing something good and doing something of value.
From Diversity Day, yeah. I remember
yeah.
sitting in that conference room going, if people give this thing a shot,
yeah.
this is funny. And it's doing something different. It's looking at the world outside in an interesting and complex way.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you feel like the show reflected the outside world, you know, in terms of like Diversity Day or Gay Witch Hunt or?
Well, starting with the quality of our writing staff, those first few seasons, especially before everyone became big deals and went off to do right. their own shows. Right. I mean, that's what happens. You get these great people like Mindy Kaling and Mike Schur, and we had a ton of them. We had a really, really deep bench of writers. And when you have a bunch of people who are that funny and that smart, for me, the hardest part of it was servicing the script, making sure I didn't, because I get dialogue every day and think I can't screw this up because I knew it had to be delivered in just the right way.
Right.
Because, or otherwise you're not servicing this great writing. So I think we all felt that there was a responsibility to get it right because the writing was so consistent in terms of how it reflected society, but to do it in a way that wasn't too heavy-handed and felt organic to what we were doing as characters. And that was the other great part of having run. I mean, I was there for 7 years. You were there for 9 to be able to trace the evolution of a character and have something in mind and be able to talk to the writers and talk to Greg Daniels and say, what if next season my character went in this direction? And then it happened. And I think everyone trusted each other to such a degree that, you know, that was, they were willing to, you know, not be too precious about yeah. anything. And I think it became better because of that.
Greg told me something. I did not know this. Maybe you knew this. I mean, obviously, one thing that he did that was unique was he sort of tried to obliterate the barriers between the writer's room and the actors. Yeah. And because he said, for him, this show was about behavior. And you can't write behavior. You can't write body posture. You can't write a specific look on your face, which I thought was so interesting.
That's really smart. I know. I never heard that, but it completely makes sense. And the fact that so many of the writers were actors on the show, not just watching. Another thing I liked was that when we were on set, it was pretty much just us and the camera crew and the director all the time. So it felt as close to what we were supposed to be doing. You know, it was as close to doing a documentary without actually doing one as it could feel. But yeah, having writers there and seeing how the actors work and maybe tweak a line or improvise and find something, and to have to have Mindy, to have Paul, to have BJ all there, not just as actors, but as fuel and right. and having incredible suggestions or ideas or things to throw in, rewrites. I mean, I don't know how much footage there is on the cutting room floor, but you could edit an entire season for sure of stories, whole storylines that were cut out that yeah. were hilarious and were just cut for time.
Yeah.
I mean, our scripts were long and our first cuts of things, they had to be what, 20 minutes?
Yeah, 21, 22. Yeah.
And they'd have 35-minute cuts, their first cut, 40-minute cuts. Sometimes they just split them in half and we'd have two shows.
Yeah.
That happened a couple of times.
Do you remember, was there anything for you that you recall that was cut? People ask, like, was there anything that was cut? Either a story or...
I mean, there. No, I'm on.
Yeah,
no.
You don't remember.
I don't. I just don't know. I mean, I would see things in there and think, oh, yeah, I remember. I remember we shot that.
That's right. I know. I recently went back and watched the whole thing. Claire Scanlon told me the story, which I certainly did not remember. But there was an episode where Jim and Pam are fighting. And the episode came in and it was really long. And someone had the idea, well, let's just make it a silent fight. And it's just going to be about looks. Like, we're not going to have them. We're going to cut any exchange between the two of them. And the episode is just going to exist as a silent fight throughout the whole thing. And at the very end, just as they're walking out to their car, they hold hands. And it just, like, flips the whole thing. But the entire story that had been written and shot was just gone.
That's a great move, though. And probably so much more powerful than all the dialogue they could have said, you know, because that passive aggressive, that subtle silent between couples can speak volumes. Not that I would have any personal knowledge of that.
Oh, no.
No.
No,
certainly not.
Absolutely.
I'm just saying,
why would you have
a writer and an actor?
Yes.
But yeah, that's a great move. And I think they did stuff like that all the time. You know, those editors, we had some great, great people. And so much of the story obviously is told there. And I felt like our job was just to supply them with as much fodder for whatever it was going to become. But I didn't get precious about anything because I just knew, again, it's just a matter of trust. I trusted Greg and Dave and Claire, and I trusted everyone in the cast and all of those writers. That's such a great environment to work in when you just know, do your job and they're going to take it and craft it into something that works. And I think everyone did that. Everyone. So the level, I don't think what people know necessarily is that as much, if not more than anything I've ever worked on, the universal level of commitment on that show across the board, actors, writers, crew, people were in. And it's rare, but I think we all sensed it. We all knew. And it's not like the show, we were never a friends. We were always sort of the outcast, you know.
Ugly duckling
or
the little engine that could. Yes.
For sure.
Yes.
And we got those kind of reviews. We never, you know, there were never articles written about The Office back then. But I'm personally so proud of the fact that in spite of all of the negativity that I think kind of surrounded it, at least at first, that group was completely committed.
100 I feel like we all sort of, it was like we came up together, which helped us form a very unique bond.
I completely agree. The relationships between all of us, and again, doing this other show that I'm doing now, just being able to work with, you know, 5, 6, 7 people that I had worked with for 7 years, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
It just goes from one thing to the other because there is that commonality. There is that sense of we came up together. It's so hard to talk about it without hyperbole too, because I find myself like, it's the great, you know.
No.
I don't want to tout it too much. I don't want to put too much emphasis on how great we all think it was. But I mean, you know, people can judge whatever the show is and however they like it.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
oldest girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
Well, upon repeated viewings, they, you know, if they find all of this stuff in it, and that is great. But from a personal perspective, having worked on it was the joy. Like having these friendships and that work experience, I knew when I was doing it that this was going, nothing was going to be better than this. As a work experience, I didn't know whether it would be the best thing I'd ever be a part of, or I knew it would be hard to top, certainly, but just in terms of a personal experience and the rewards from that, nothing will ever come close to it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, certainly, I don't want to go into hyperbole either, but I think trying to at least examine the question of why, you know, we were so close. Maybe it's because we came up together. And to me, the other element was we had such a wide range of experience. You know, like Rain and myself, for example, we were like doing Chekhov the month before. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that and improv and stand-up and sort of all of those experiences. Phyllis told me the story. Oh, my God. I don't know if you've ever heard this. She got cast. She came in and she was watching everybody improv. And she said, I can't do that. So the first season, she went on her way home, drove to the bookstore and bought books on improv and were reading books.
She did?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
I never knew that either.
That's shocking to me because I always thought she was
so pure, so good.
Like one of the best improvisers of any of us. Because it was, everything was completely honest and she just listened and she would just respond within character. That's what it is.
Right.
You know, that's the crux of it. Wow. That's, I think all those things you say are true. I think the fact that Greg was able to cast people that it just, the chemistry was there. People genuinely cared about each other because there were times that people would be in the background for hours and just be seen, like in profile, while other scenes were taking place in the foreground. And I never, ever heard one complaint by anyone.
Yeah.
You know, it was, to me, it was the true definition of an ensemble. more than anything, I think that's why it worked, is because there were no, I don't think anyone wanted to stick out in any way. I think everyone just felt a joy in being part of that unit.
When we come back, our executive producer, Ben Silverman, joins our unit for a conversation about the structure of the show and a little thing called the director sandwich. It's a hard time for hiring, so you need a hiring partner built for hard times. That's Indeed. If you're hiring, you need Indeed, because Indeed is the hiring partner where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. And Indeed is the only job site where you're guaranteed to find quality applications that meet your must-have requirements, or else you don't pay. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites hoping to find candidates with the right skills, you need one hiring partner that can help you do it all. Indeed partners with you on every step of the hiring process. Find great talent through time-saving tools like Indeed Instant Match, assessments, and virtual interviews. With Instant Match, as soon as you sponsor a post, you get a short list of quality candidates with resumes on Indeed that match your job description, and you can invite them to apply right away. Plus, you only pay for quality applications that meet your must-have requirements. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring right now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/Office Deep Dive. Offer valid through March 31st. Go to Indeed.com/Office Deep Dive to claim your $75 credit before March 31st. Indeed.com/Office Deep Dive. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
From the creator of The Bright Sessions comes a new fiction podcast for all ages. Jump back to 1997 and follow Maxine Miles as she starts high school in the picturesque town of Hastings, New Hampshire. Fall is a season in which this small town shines. Apple cider, pumpkin patches, farmers markets. It's idyllic for adults and boring for Max. But suddenly, Max's school year starts to look a bit more interesting when a fellow student vanishes. With the help of her misanthropic classmate, Ross, Max starts to look into the disappearance. Her investigation draws her deep into the dark woods around Hastings and even deeper into the secrets and lies that course through the veins of this sleepy town. This new YA mystery from writer-director Lauren Chippen is an audio drama with heart and wit that involves the audience in a way no fiction podcast ever has. Listen to Maxine Miles on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite shows.
Have you ever felt depressed about work, only to have your dad be like, "Why are you so down?" So you told him you hate your job, and he said, "Well, you better talk yourself out of it." And then you thought, I love to talk. I could host a podcast. And then you went to Spreaker from iHeart and started a podcast and got good at it, then monetized it, then quit your boring job, then told your dad, "Thanks for the advice." And he was like, "Well, that's not what I meant, and I don't understand what a podcast is, but you seem happy, so that's great, kiddo." You ever do that? Well, you could. At Spreaker.com. That's Spreaker. Ask your dad. You actually don't.
I was talking to a couple of people just about, I had a French director I worked with for a while that he taught me that comedy exists off the beat. It happens either quicker or takes longer, that pause, but did you never land it right on the beat? I feel like our show did really well on that. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, for example, a bad joke that then you get a reaction from Jim, that then you get a reaction from somebody, and the laugh could go sort of at any place.
Yes. And there was a lot going on between the lines there, and the writers were aware of that. They were aware of the pauses. They were aware of, like, at the end of, it was Office Olympics. There's a scene where we're all getting our like tin awards,
yeah,
and
yogurt metal lids, yeah.
the yogurt lids. And I remember that turned into a really emotional moment for Michael Scott because someone was giving him an award and it was important in that moment. And I was talking to Greg about this, and I don't think any of us realized until we started doing it that that scene was going to have that sort of emotional and comedic resonance, because it wasn't scripted. It was just this moment where Jim looks at Michael and realizes this is a big deal. And Michael starts to cry out of joy and pride. And it turned into something very different. And I think part of the, for my character, part of the trick was to not let on where the jokes were.
Yeah.
Because Michael generally wouldn't. He wouldn't know, he wouldn't have an awareness that anything he was saying was funny unless he was trying to be funny. So to try to mask the absurdity of the line within somebody just believing it and not commenting on it as an actor while you say it, not leaning into the joke of the line. I think that was something that was really tricky.
Did the production style help you do that at
For
all?
For sure,
the
yeah.
way that it wasn't as...
The production style helped everything because there wasn't that... It wasn't intricate. The lighting took 5 minutes and we all looked terrible all the time.
Right.
So there was no vanity involved.
Maybe
either.
That's why the networks didn't like us.
Probably. Yeah, probably. I mean, we all looked like real people.
We yeah, and we were up, we came out of the Baywatch age. You know, we were born of the last part.
But to kind of throw away all the vanity too was very,
yes.
You know, that was great because no one was worried about getting touched up all the time. We were just kind of in our characters and doing our thing, and that's not what the show is predicated on.
Right.
And so in that sense, I think it felt more like a documentary too.
It lent the authenticity
for sure.
Yeah, and reality.
Yeah.
And then the performance played out.
I mean, the other level, just the camera as a character adds an entirely other layer of comedy that doesn't exist, even if you're just playing out a scene. In other words, your awareness... As a character, you have your own behavior and your intention with this character, but you also are either playing to the camera
yeah.
or hiding from the camera.
It's been the bane of my existence since I've left the office.
Yeah, I'm sure.
To revert to the other?
In everything I've done since the office, at least once I will inadvertently do a take to the camera.
Oh.
And I do it, and then I think, why did I just do that?
No, I do too.
I mean, obviously we can't use it
right.
because we're not doing
You're
a documentary
wall,
here.
Right?
Yeah, you just break that wall, but it's such a weird, it's a habit.
Tick. Do you do it with the family at dinner?
It's almost impossible to break. I'm sure on Foxcatcher, I did a take to the camera. Like, well, maybe not appropriate.
Did you say this or did Greg say this to you? There was some discussion about the essence of Michael Scott playing to the camera was Michael believing that if he did a really good job, that maybe Jennifer Aniston would go out with him. Do you remember that?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't actually remember
okay,
that.
Okay, no, that's fine.
It sounds good, though.
Somebody said that, like that early on.
Yeah.
I can't remember if it was Greg.
He's beguiling the camera because his hope is he gets discovered by the girl.
You think you're funny. You think you're charming. You put your foot in it.
Yeah.
But you think that. You're like, oh, wasn't that a good one, Jennifer Aniston?
Right,
that's
watching.
The subtext? Yeah, exactly.
You know who I think was one of the best right off the bat was Amy Adams. I remember when she came in to do her first episode, because it's sort of a tricky thing, that look to the camera and how hard you play it or how subtly you play it. But she had it down. I remember that first episode, because she was aware of the camera, but she played it in a very different way. Like, because she was an outsider. She didn't
like, what are you
work
doing
there?
Here?
Like, did you just record what I just said? There's like, I'd forgotten that you're there and now I know you're there. And there's like all this other stuff going on. So the camera, yeah, the camera really, you could always use it, you know, and it was for Michael, it was free reign, you know, because he could always be on. And when the camera was documenting things that were more vulnerable that he didn't want the camera to see, you know, you could show the fragility of the character as well and not wanting to be captured or kind of assuming a different character to cover the fragility that, you know, was intrinsic to him. So that camera as a character added, I think, a depth to all of the characters. And it's a reflection, I think, of what you want the public to see,
as opposed to
what is the reality of the situation or the reality of the person.
The layering of all of that, also, as you were talking, I was thinking one of the things that's so arresting now when you go into our show.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
In a world digitally of 1,000 shows, and you just see her, we feel black and white. You know, we feel almost sepia and
like analog.
Yeah, analog. You know, yeah. In all of that, and yet it has so much more of that honesty and connectivity. But I think what that does is it frames the performance and that kind of thing. It lets the face and the performance and the pathos and the comedy all play through character because it's not the bells and whistles. And yeah. Everything jumping around.
Well, so much of that was just the ensemble nature of it, yeah. Too. That it's like an orchestra, you know, there to know when to fade back and allow the brass section to go, yes. You know, and it's their solo or it's the violins or it's such a stupid analogy, but allowing everyone to shine and everyone to have their moment. I didn't feel like there were all these separate components bouncing off each other. It was like this one group energy that moved through all of those years together and it morphed into different shapes, but it was all, we couldn't lose any components of that because it morphed as a whole. It was a, I don't know, maybe that's getting too deep into it, but
no.
But that's the way I felt about that ensemble,
yes.
Is that everyone was so strong and so vital to the life of the whole thing. The show could shift on a dime based on one thing that one character introduces. And it might be a line that was scripted. It might have been something improvised. But everyone else would shift with it. And you could feel it, you know. Well, like being a good interviewer on the radio, you can tell there's a give and take and allowing for space. And it's a real talent. It's a real ability. And I think all of that cast had that same ability to sense where it was all going.
Where it should go next.
Yes. Yeah. And that was so exciting.
Yeah. It's funny too, because people talk, and which is all true, about the ensemble expanding as time went on and we got into more stories of other characters and other characters were able to shine. That's true. And pretty much everybody did something in Diversity Day, which is the second episode.
Yeah.
And, you know, almost everybody has a joke or a moment. It was being built early. And I think Ken and Greg, those guys, do you remember the 30 minutes of Busy Work?
Oh, early on?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so his thing. Right down to how he starts a scene. He doesn't say action. He says, go ahead. In the most calm, inviting way. Go ahead.
Yeah. I will say, like, to give him shit, it becomes funny to me because he has it's not just the go ahead, it's the go ahead. Like he always pretends as though he's about to say something else. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what, you know, after the 500th time you go, man, you can't fool me anymore.
Have we ever talked about the director's sandwich?
No.
Have you ever heard of this?
No.
I don't know where I heard this from, but it is like clockwork. It is the experience I've had on every show with every director, and I'm sure you've had the same experience.
Okay,
director sandwich.
Director sandwich.
The director sandwich, the first layer of bread is the first compliment. Director comes in, it's going great, we love it, everybody back there loves what you're doing. The meat or the filling is the note. Maybe you could pick it up and maybe a little more touch of energy. And the last piece of bread is the second compliment. But we love it. You're doing great. Just do what you're doing and just have fun.
Right.
Every director does exactly the same thing.
That's so right. That's so true.
As soon as that's in your head, you will always be aware of that now. Like, okay, now what's he trying to say? What is the meat here? What is the note?
The producer sandwich has no meat. Great job. See you guys in an hour. See you in Cabo.
Do you ever, this is sort of off topic, but it's fascinating to me, when you're in a scene and you get the first layer of bread, great job, really, really doing well. Dave. And then turns to the other guy, right? And there's a part of you that's like, whew, wasn't me. Was everything? I must be doing okay. And then they give the meat to Dave. And then it's really working well. And then it's take two. Director comes back again. Great job. Dave, right? And then, yes, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I've been Dave before, for sure.
We all have been Dave. We all don't want to be Dave, but we have all been Dave. But it's almost worse when you're not Dave, but
it's even worse than that is when you are tanking a scene and then your scene partner, when you're trying to get it going again and try to figure out how you're going to save your lousy performance, your scene partner, in a very gracious and lovely way, says, is there anything I can do to help? is there anything I can do from my side? Like, oh no. Now I'm really Dave.
Oh, Dave. That is so true.
And they're just being nice.
Can I give you something?
Can I give
you
something more than I'm giving so your performance is adequate?
When we come back, Steve and I kick Ben out of the studio to get into the true psyche of Michael Scott.
Adoption of teens from foster care is a topic not enough people know about, and we're here to change that. I'm April Dinwiddie, host of the new podcast, Navigating Adoption, presented by Adopt US Kids. Each episode brings you compelling real-life adoption stories told by the families that live them, with commentary from experts.
Visit AdoptUSKids.org/podcast or subscribe to Navigating Adoption, presented by Adopt US Kids. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families and the Ad Council.
I'm Jake Halpern, host of Deep Cover. Our new season is about a lawyer who helped the mob run Chicago.
We controlled the courts. We controlled absolutely everything.
He bribed judges and even helped a hitman walk free. Until one day when he started talking with the FBI and promised that he could take the mob down. I've spent the past year trying to figure out why he flipped and what he was really after.
From my perspective, Bob was too good to be true. There's got to be something wrong with this.
I wouldn't trust that guy. He looks like a little scumbag liar, stool pigeon. He looked like what he was, a rat.
I can say with all certainty, I think he's a hero because he didn't have to do what he did, and he did it anyway.
The moment I put the wire on the first time, my life was over. If it ever got out, they would kill me in a heartbeat.
Listen to Deep Cover on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Emmy Olea. On this podcast, I'm taking you on a search for love.
Emmy, 24, hardworking Latina, seeks cool, down-to-earth guy. Swipe, swipe, swipe.
It's hard out there for a girl. To find Mr. Right, I've had to meet a lot of Mr. Wrongs.
He'd invite me over to have dinner with his family. I knew he didn't tell them that I was transgender.
Dating as a trans woman can be complicated, but there were other reasons I felt like I couldn't always be myself.
He's asking me things about my family, like my mom's in prison. My grandmother was arrested for working with the Mexican drug cartel.
This is Crumbs. My love story. It's a show about the things we settle for and the bits of ourselves that make us who we are. Listen to Crumbs as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There is a question I've never asked you. This is my memory, at least going back, right? You remember things differently. We would have a 7-8-page conference room scene, and we would come in to rehearse, and you would, like, kind of flip your pages, and you weren't playing a part like the absent-minded professor, but this was, like, my, right? It was just like, oh, wait, what are we here? How... Oh, okay. I'm standing in the front of the idea of like you had no idea what was going on. And we would do it once maybe and be like, okay, do we have it? Okay, good. And you would go away and it was like you would finish putting on your suit and then we would start rolling and it was all there. Was that intentional for you? Was there – no, I mean –
Well, keep him nothing. Nothing was intentional. No.
But I mean like were you – like in retrospect, I started thinking, oh – as an improver, he wants it to be as fresh as possible. Though at times it also got annoying that you were attempting to bring the group to a place where, like, you were trying to make them laugh. Was that intentional? Was that...
Sometimes. I think we all tried to make each other laugh.
Of course. Yes.
To me, there's nothing more boring than listening to myself talk about process. But
no, but that's but there. I'm truly curious.
I will tell. Well, just based on the page count every day, and also on how quickly lines changed, we could have rewrites the morning of.
Yes.
So I just didn't have time to memorize stuff the night before because right.
You'd go home after 12, 14 hours.
Yeah. I'd go to bed and wake up and be in the next day and sort of get into that day's work. But I think it became fairly easy to remember stuff because of the writing.
That's
because
so true.
I think they tuned into every character's voice and they really wrote the dialogue within those voices. And it is infinitely easier to remember lines when they make sense within your character. So sometimes I would just have to look at these long, chunky scenes and I put the blocks together in terms of, okay, where are, you know, where are kind of our joke beats and where are, you know, where our story beats and what's shoe leather and just kind of try to process that and then not think about it. Just kind of try to lock in the structure of it and then just play the scene. And that was the joy of how loose it all was when we got in there to shoot too, because we'd have two cameras covering everything. If you got something well once, you got it from two separate angles. You have cutting points, you know, an editor's dream, really, because Right. Everything was covered at least by two cameras. There was never, oh, so-and-so said something funny, but it was, you know, it was a single on somebody else. And then to try to go back and recreate whatever had happened, they were picking up a lot of stuff. And so when things happen in real time, generally they were able to get it. So there's a comfort in that too, knowing that it's not like you were going to have to generate it many, many times over. And you could make every take different. You didn't have to necessarily match what you did the first time. You could play with it. And as actors, we could all throw stuff in and try a different, you know, beat for the ending or try some, you know, some different dialogue. But in terms of, yeah, those long scenes, I just didn't want to waste anybody's time either. Because if I'd fumfered through all of those things and I tried to put enough pressure on myself to lock into it, you know, and try to not make everybody stay for 14 hours.
Right.
Because I can't remember the big speech at the end of the thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's part of it. I mean, just out of respect for everybody else's time.
No, of course, That was always just very impressive. That's it. I'm not saying anything nice. But it was, I often wondered about that. I mean, Rainn Wilson, I don't know, the two of you together was so stupid.
So stupid,
but so funny. I recently went back and watched, I went start to finish.
Wow.
I hadn't gone back at all since they aired. And just the dynamic between the two of you, it's like when you're in grade school and there's the cool kids, right? The Ryan and Jim, and you want to be friends with them. And then you've got the kind of slightly more nerdy friend of yours that wants to be, and you're like, just call me after school.
Yeah.
I'll play with you later because I'm trying to get in. I don't know. There was just something about the dynamic between you two. He called you a Picasso of improv.
Oh my gosh.
But I mean,
well, he, you know, I remember auditioning with Rainn and we instantly were making each other laugh, like right from the start. And I'll crack up as much as anyone, but I try not to because I always feel like if I laugh, it's going to ruin that. Whatever they're doing is so funny.
Right.
And if I crack up, it's unusable, but there are times that I'm sure you can watch the show and just see tears welling in my eyes. That was one of the hardest things was to not, you know, to not lose it. Rainn, he's such an interesting, just an interesting human being. He's such a kind, he's such a dichotomy because he is, he's an incredibly loving and kind and gentle.
Yes.
Like cares, truly.
Truly cares.
Someone who cares about the universe in a far-reaching way.
Yes.
And a much, much better person than I am.
Or me.
But at the same time, the biggest curmudgeon.
And like crass.
Oh.
Rude.
Rude. Yes. Rude. Like unfiltered honesty. And.
Yes. He'll drag you. Yes. Just under, gross sexual for no reason.
But so, gosh, he's a great guy. And there's a scene toward the end when Dwight reads the letter of reference from Michael Scott that just puts a pretty fine point on their relationship. After all of the stuff that Michael has put Dwight through, at his core, he loves him
yeah.
and appreciates him and understands how loyal he had been that entire time, and had at for the greater part of the series had really been his only advocate.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael for sure understood that. He might have resented it. He might have wanted more. You know, he could be very petty and immature, but at the same time, in that moment, you know, certainly acknowledges how important Dwight is to him.
Do you, as an actor, do you always search for the good in the character that you're portraying?
Sure, I think you have to.
I do too.
Because otherwise you're just demonizing or judging the people that you're playing. And if you're judging a character that you're playing, you're going to play it differently.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to editorialize about a character you're playing, I think.
100%. Yeah.
I think Michael's a decent dude with a lot of heart, but he's so, based on his childhood, based on all sorts of things and things that he had lacked growing up, things that I felt he was deprived of. He was so hungry for acceptance, but I don't think he had the strongest templates in the world to go by. But I think he also learned and evolved and became a better person along the way. And he was just a bit myopic and became more aware once he sort of was able to start stepping outside of himself and his own little eccentricities. He could see a little bit more about the world around him.
Yeah.
I think one of the things about Michael is he's actually this, and in terms of my interpretation of him, I feel like he would look out at all the people who worked with him, and it's like he would put his foot in his mouth all the time. But in a lot of ways, I don't think he ever valued one person or type of person over any other. And in that way, I think he was a very pure character, because he's very dumb in terms of political correctness and being appropriate in public. Right. But at the same time, I just don't think there was hardness in his heart towards anyone.
Yes, I agree with that.
I think a person with an enormously good, kind heart who lacked a great deal of information about the world around him and was as asleep in a woke world as you could be.
Right, but trying his best.
Trying his best. And actually, there's a difference between being intolerant and being ignorant. And sometimes intolerance and ignorance go hand in hand, for sure. They do. But I think he was a decent human being, really.
Yeah.
He just didn't get it all the time.
When the show was happening, my mom and dad, they had friends. And they would say, oh, we can't watch that show. Like that Michael Scott, he makes me too uncomfortable. I can't watch that. And I always felt that this came from a place of deep insecurity or like misogynistic or racist or homophobic feelings within themselves. Like that's why it was uncomfortable at times.
Mm-hmm.
And then you came out. Thanks a lot for saying this. I get asked about it all the time that the show could never be made now. This was
not exactly what I said.
Okay, but, well, that's great, because I have always said that I thought that Steve was misquoted in this.
Yeah, that's
thing.
Not. I don't know. I don't know if it could be made now. Maybe it could. I guess my point was that I think what I was trying to say was that exact same show probably wouldn't be made today, but with the same components, the same actors, the same writers. If it were to come back, it would evolve into the 2020 version of what we did back then. I mean, I think the writing would be a bit different in today's climate, but I don't think it would be any less insightful. I don't think it would be any less smart or any less funny. It would just be different.
Right.
That's all. I just,
that's totally fair.
And I do think it would be different.
Yeah.
I think Michael Scott would be much more tuned in to what it is to be woke. He would not understand it necessarily,
right.
But he would be, the comedy would be coming from his struggle to understand and fit into the world as we know it today, because the world as we knew it 15 years ago is different than it is today. But, you know, you take that same character who is trying to speak the language of modern times.
Right.
That can be very funny, but it would just be different. It would just be a different set of rules for today.
Right.
But I don't know. I think it's easy to say that you can't be funny. You can't do comedy this day and age. I think that's a bit of a cop-out because, every time you turn around, there is somebody coming up with something that is of the time and inventive and doesn't shirk away from our responsibility to look in the mirror. I think it just takes a level of intelligence to be able to do that.
Yeah. Here's my other theory, just in terms of like why the show is so popular today, and mm-hmm. especially with younger people and me going back and watching it, and it doesn't feel dated.
Right.
And Greg was so adamant about the realistic elements of the way people looked and that it felt lived in and the way that it's shot. I feel like if maybe subconsciously people are, they obviously know it's not a documentary, but that it's just about this time and this place.
Well, I think it's because of what you said before. It's about behavior. It's about human behavior. And human behavior is pretty universal and doesn't change a whole lot. You know, the question has gone around so often about why the resurgence in popularity. Why does it seem to be more popular now than it was back then? But beyond that, why do 12 and 13-year-olds and 10-year-olds, why do they like it? That was always a shock to me.
Shocker.
Because when we were making the show, I thought, well, people who have worked in an office environment have a context. I can get it. I think they'd have something that they could find in here. But the fact that not even teenagers, but like preteens.
Right.
Apparently, Billie Eilish is a big fan and has been for years. And I got a note from her and we've corresponded a little bit. And it's shocking that, you know, I sound like I'm 80 years old, but these younger generations,
right.
And it almost seems to have been passed down from their older siblings too. I don't know. I don't know. But you know, I try not to even question it too much because it's a miracle that the show still gets the kind of attention that it does. When are people going to get sick of it? When does the shoe drop? And then it's just, ugh. When does the backlash start? That's my question.
I don't know.
Is that when this comes out?
Probably. It's the week before. The week before, it's just done. Yes.
You know what? We all were so lucky.
Oh, please.
And
yes.
I think that permeates the whole vibe of the show, too, because we knew we were all hanging by a thread, and we were just going to enjoy it, and there was no cockiness at all.
No.
There was no arrogance. Everybody was just happy to be employed and working with this group and kind of clinging to each other, because we also knew that this is a once-in-a-lifetime conglomeration of people, and let's enjoy it.
Yeah.
I mean, as an actor, to have an experience like that, you know, we're lucky if we just get to work.
Right.
And get paid and make a living. Come on. That's all any of us wanted. That's the other thing that I think was baseline for everyone on that show. Really, all we wanted to do was make livings as actors. No, I think no one aspired to anything beyond that. And so there was complete contentment in what we had there.
But I would add to that, that that is what people wanted, was to make a living as an actor.
Yeah.
And at the same time, that we felt so lucky that we were actually able to make a living on something that was actually good and cared about.
Right.
That then took it to like.
I completely agree.
Yeah. You haven't died. Okay. I'm just going to say that. And it's very difficult for me to be overly nice. Mm. But there is something that I need you to hear, that when Michael left and you left at the same time, weirdly.
Yeah. They coincided.
They coincided. It was so bizarre. It's like, where is Michael? Steve left earlier today. But it needs to be acknowledged that, you know, for us, Michael Scott was an amazing creation, but you were equally as special.
That's really nice of you to say. Well, it was a special group, and to find that dynamic, you know, actors, a TV show, you know, throwing all of that aside, just to have a group of people that you care so much about, and you can't wait to see the next day. I tend to do that, though, career-wise. I tend to leave, and I've done this a few times. I left Second City when it was the best job in the world. I couldn't imagine it being any better. I was having the most fun of my life. I gotta go. Because I don't want to get comfortable. And I did the same thing on The Daily Show. I was there for 4 years or so, and okay, this is perfect. And Nancy, my wife, we're both correspondents. This is fantastic. Love it. We're having a ball. And we both decided, oh, gotta go. You know, let's just keep it moving on. And I sort of did the same thing on The Office. Like you don't want it to, and maybe it's out of fear. Maybe it's like you don't want it to turn a corner in any way. You don't want it to be in any way less than it ever was. So maybe that's something about me that, you know, I should examine, see somebody about, but it's so maybe it's a defense mechanism that way, but I was just so proud to be part of it. And it was very difficult for me to leave, because I loved everybody.
I didn't start by asking this because it didn't occur to me. And then people started talking, and I've been asking people, what was the greater loss? Was it Steve or was it Michael Scott? And two stories have come up a number of times. One I haven't heard. I want to share this with you.
Okay.
Mike Schur. He said this. There was a budgetary meeting and they were trying to slash budget because they were always trying to slash the budget. And one of the things on the table was reducing the size of the cast. I can't remember who was there, but there were executives in the room. And Steve, who was a producer at the time, said, nope, nope, no, no, no. Like he said no like 8 times in a row. It's not happening. That is not going to happen. And it just shut it down. It shut it down forever and no one ever brought it up again. And I think that everybody felt that from you, that the ensemble was so important to you. And I don't even know if there's a question.
Wow, it was a very strong thing inside of me, that group. And I felt very protective of everybody, but I think everyone felt that way. You know, standing up to, like, no one was going to put any one of us down in any way. But I got that sense from not just the cast, but the crew and the writers and all the producers. It sounds like such a crock. And, no, you know, I sound like I'm accepting a...
I know. That's why
sort.
I said you've died. And it's not that, but it's, and look, it's part of it is that you said, like, no, these were the guys who were here. This is our show.
But can you imagine?
No.
I mean, can you imagine at that point? And I wasn't a producer until a few years in we were down the road. That had to be like season 4.
Yeah.
So, I mean, no, there's no way. Like, yeah. What? No, it didn't make sense. Unless people wanted to move on, unless they're...
Sure, but, totally.
But for finance, that's the other thing. The budgetary, do you remember the product integration stuff that we had to go through?
Oh, Staples Shredder?
It was the Staples Shredder. It was Chili's.
The Chili's thing.
Oh, man. That was a thorn in my side. I remember when one executive came in and said, hey, for budgetary reasons, we would like to partner up with some of these companies and do some product integration. And that is that. That's definitely the one time I feel like I raised my hand and said, we can't. I'm very much against this because I think it definitely changes the show. If we are serving a corporate master, there's no way the show will be the same. If we're putting in any sort of products, it's going to alter how we write the show, how we perform the show. I was dead set against it. And they went ahead and did a couple things anyway. And each time they were disasters. they were terrible.
The Chili's thing, Greg, I wasn't even going to bring that up to you, but what Greg talked about, that he called you a great improver of life. He told a story about Chili's coming and saying, no, Pam can't be drunk. And Greg said he was full-blown panicking.
Yeah, like, we were 3 days into the shoot. Yeah. We were going to lose the whole episode.
Yeah, and you said, no, well, and you just, that's what he was talking about, like a life improver. Like, here's a situation. Let me find the yes and or whatever.
Yeah, we found a way out of it.
Yeah. Do you have any specific memories that you want to share from your last day or few days on set, or the last episode?
That was so, well, for starters, 6 months before, I talked to Greg about how I wanted Michael to go out, like what I thought sort of a final arc would be. And the idea that I pitched was, you know, obviously he and Holly would be together, but I said specifically on his last day, I thought that there should be a party being planned, but that he should basically trick people into thinking he was leaving the next day. Because I just thought that would be the most elegant representation of his growth as a human being. That he, because Michael lives to be celebrated. You think that's all he wants. He wants to be the center of attention.
Right.
And he wants pats on the back. He wants people to think he's funny and charming and all of those things. But the fact that he'd walk away from his big tribute, his big send-off, and be able to, in a very personal way, say goodbye to each character, that to me felt like it would resonate. And it was almost more than I bargained for, because that's what happened. I had scenes with everyone in the cast. And it was emotional torture, yeah. Because imagine saying goodbye for a week. It wasn't, you know,
right.
See you later,
right.
And you wave and you're out. No, it was like just fraught with emotion and joy and sadness and nostalgia, but it was also really beautiful. Like, I treasure it. I'd like treasure just doing that episode, because it did allow me to kind of have a finality with everybody. And they were all different. Like I had one with Toby that wasn't very nostalgic at all, but very fitting of my, but even in that, certainly not as a character, to be nostalgic, but to kind of have that final scene with Paul, you know, I can't show the emotion that's actually weighted behind it as a human being for just me and Paul.
Right.
So it was a dance, you know, it was tricky, but I remember the last take, and we were shooting in the bullpen, we were shooting in the main set, And I started to feel like, uh-oh, I felt like, I think there are more people in the vicinity. Because all I could see were the cast.
Right.
But then I just got the sense, you know, you just get a sense of like, okay,
something's happening.
Something's happening. And as soon as that last take, the room just filled with people. And, you know, it was all the writers and crew and it was, well, I mean, you were there. It was ridiculously emotional.
Right. Someone told me, leading back up to the finale of the series, that why would Michael come back? Mm-hmm. And you said, well, if Dwight got married, is that true?
I had told Greg, I just don't think it's a good idea because I felt like Michael's story had definitely ended. And I was reticent about coming back because I didn't want that ending to be at all about Michael, because you guys had two more really valuable seasons. And I just didn't feel like it was right for Michael's return to take anything away from that. That was everyone else's ending. Michael had already had his, so mm-hmm. I just didn't want to. But at the same time, I felt like I should, out of respect for all of you guys and out of my love for everybody, to acknowledge the ending of this thing.
Mm-hmm. Your kids watch it?
Never.
No, come on.
They've never watched it. And I completely get it. Like, why would you? That's just weird, you know, watch your dad do that thing.
Really?
Although, okay, so my daughter's a freshman, college.
Yes.
And
you said you going, well, that was became a thing because everyone's watched.
She's totally cool with it. It's okay. Not, you know, over that weirdness and nobody makes a big deal of it at college. But taking a course in communications and the subject matter was like the paradox of comedy or something. Then this is like a big lecture.
Oh,
hall.
Right. Like a huge mass.
And they are studying an episode of The Office, which she's never seen. And she texted us like, that was really funny. Like, thanks, hon. But she said, it's so weird. She said, I never thought I would be studying something that
you did,
that my father was in, like for a course.
Right.
I just think that's hilarious how that has come around.
Oh my gosh.
So funny.
Well, I thank you.
Oh, wow.
Thank you.
That was unceremonious.
No.
Terrible. Yeah.
Will you get out, actually?
Hmm.
No, seriously.
So good to see you.
It's truly so good. And weirdly, it doesn't feel like that much time has passed.
I know. It's such a cliche, but it's really true.
No.
Like, I'll run into...
You walked in, I'm like, oh, he is going to look really different now. By the way, what does this mean whenever anyone walks in, they're like, you look exactly the same.
Everyone looks exactly the same. To me.
Right.
But you know what? It's all... Have you ever been to a reunion, like a high school reunion?
And no, I avoid people at all.
You've never gone to one?
No, I don't know that I have.
It's an interesting phenomenon because you might see some. I just went back to college for a reunion of my improv group of all things.
Right.
It's the 40th. It was the 40th anniversary
of the
creation of this improv group. So I went back to celebrate that with them, and there were people I hadn't seen since college, and I graduated in 84. So it had been a long, long time, and some people, like, when you see them, there's that immediate, oh my, like, that right. is a very different looking person. And within 15 seconds, they look exactly like they did.
Right.
Because they are who they were. And it's, you immediately process back to, mm-hmm. you know, whoever they were at the time. Although you do look exactly the same. You really do. It's amazing.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
Thanks for talking to me. I so appreciate it. And we may not see each other very often, but I value your friendship and I'm always so happy to watch you in anything that you're doing. Really.
I feel the same way.
Yeah.
It's so good to see you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, Nancy's making French dip.
Oh, French dip?
I'm gonna make some French dip tonight.
Please give her my best, too. Good Lord. Oh, man. I don't know about you, but I could just start that right back over from the top. Ugh. Steve, my friend, thank you so much for sitting down with me. I mean, it's not like you have anything better to do. Or, like, a bunch of movies and TV shows to make. But still, thank you. And listeners, thank you for listening. Let me know your thoughts on this episode in the reviews. It is so helpful for me and my team. And if you enjoyed listening to Steve, well, keep an eye out or an ear out, because we will have him back on a future episode with a very special guest. Until then, we will have lots more interviews coming your way. So we will see you next week. The Office Deep Dive is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Tessa Kramer. Our associate producer is Emily Carr. And our assistant editor is Diego Tapia. My main man in the booth is Alec Moore. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend, Creed Bratton. And the episode was mixed by Seth Olansky.
Hello, this is Christina Hutchinson.
And Corinne Fisher. We're thrilled to announce that our show, Guys We F*** the Anti-Slut-Shaming Podcast, is returning to wide release.
That's right. Every Friday, we talk to one of our favorite comedians or an expert in the field of sexuality, love, and relationships. To hear what all the f***s are about, subscribe now.
And listen to the luminary original podcast, Guys We F*** starting January 21st on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gangster Chronicles podcast is a weekly conversation that revolves around the underworld. From criminals and entertainers to victims of crime and law enforcement, we cover all facets of the game. Gangster Chronicles podcast doesn't glorify or promote illicit activities. We just discuss the ramifications and repercussions of these activities. Because after all, if you play gangster games, you are ultimately rewarded with gangster prizes. Our Heart Radio is number one for podcasts, but don't take our word for it. Find the Gangster Chronicles podcast on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the latest season of the Next Question with Katie Couric podcast, Katie dives into, well, Katie. Hear exclusive podcast-only conversations between Katie and the people who made her memoir, Going There, possible.
Katie is a pack rat, and she has basically her own archive of sorts in her basements.
Plus, Katie explores some of the big news stories she's covered over the decades and the people behind them, like Anita Hill.
I thought I could just get back to my life, and that wasn't possible. It was not going to be the same.
There's plenty of Katie's signature curiosity and no-holds-barred interviews, along with some of her own revealing answers.
We spent a lot of time together around a dining room table here and in the city, and, you know, it was a very intense experience.
All episodes of Next Question with Katie Couric are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Bean Dad, The Dress,
30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week, we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet or the algorithm choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame starting May 7th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.